everyone. Thanks so much for coming tonight, and I hope you enjoyed the show. I would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land, the Darug, and pay my respects to elders past and present, and of course to acknowledge that the land that we're on, which was never ceded, was a meeting place for many, many years as a watering hole. And I really would like to acknowledge how deeply First Nations culture is embedded in all our Australian culture. So I'm Joanne Key, and I'm the executive producer and also responsible for the artistic side of all things for Riverside's National Theatre of Parramatta. And we are the commissioning, capacity building and producing arm of Riverside Theatres. And as part of this, we've had the great privilege to have Terrell here. Whilst he wrote Choir Boy, he's also here because we are running a program, a playwriting program, Staging the World. And that is really important to us, that we're working with people in our community. And five very lucky playwrights have had 2 weeks with Terrell. Yay. So for Choir Boy, Terrell's being here has happily coincided with the opening of that show, and I would again congratulate the cast, who are phenomenal, and also our directors, Zinzi Okenyo and Dino Dimitriadis, and the musical director was Alan Rene Luis. With that, now I'm going to do all the stuff that either makes you cringe or goes to your head. I think it would probably make you cringe. So Terrell is an acclaimed writer, and his plays include the Brother-Sister Plays Trilogy, Head of Passes, Wig Out, Miss Black for President, and Choir Boy, which was nominated for 4 Tony Awards. So I'm going to keep on going and embarrassing you. So there are so many awards, like really a lot. So he doesn't want me to read them, but can I say there's so many and they're really significant and meaningful. And he's also head of playwriting at Yale School of Drama and an ensemble member of Steppenwolf Theatre. So thank you so much for being here with us tonight.
You're welcome. Hi.
So when you saw Choir Boy, you actually had tears in your eyes when you attended our opening. And I have heard this story from you, but I'd love you to tell our audience, what was it that was different about this production and what moved you?
Yeah. Hi, everyone. My name is Terrell Alvin McCraney. My pronouns are he, him. I hail from Miami, Florida, which is the ancestral ground of the Tequesta and the Cacique. It is now the stewarded land of the Miccosukee and the Seminole. I am a descendant of folks who were forced into enslavement in the transatlantic slave trade, and my family hails from the Caribbean and the Georgia lands. And we sang songs a lot. I grew up in choirs and in hearing many stories through song and dance. And so one of the ways in which my heritage was passed to me was through this music that you heard in Choir Boy. How many of you saw the play tonight? Yeah, cool. Thank y'all for coming. And, the cast is here. Yay! James and More Blessing will tell you, I clap at everything. Like, I celebrate everything. It's like, wait for the airplane. Yay! Like, it's just, it's what we do. So one of the ways in which I knew that I was a part of a culture was that I was passed these songs, right? Like, my grandmother taught me these songs. My grandfather, who was a minister, taught me the importance of the work songs. Some of these songs are both secular and sacred, meaning that they are both for religious purposes and they are also for protesting, right? Therefore, striking out against injustice. And I also want to just name, I had a really bad asthma attack earlier today. So if you see me like taking a second to catch more air, that's what I'm doing. I don't want you to think anything is wrong. It's fine. I've got my inhaler on me. We're ready. So the these songs were, they sort of taught me that I was now an adult, for lack of a better word. And one of the things that was staggering about, and has been staggering about Choir Boy, is having to reteach some of that legacy. That when folks, young people in our community are past this music, it means something. It holds a truth to it. There is a kind of ceremony to it. And that often gets lost in translation. I can't write an essay every time I hand out the play to explain that, right? And so sometimes productions don't get that. So sometimes I go to productions like, hey, I'll just sit in the back. Hopefully things are copacetic. And I can say, you all did a good job, and leave, right? Just keeping it honest. You'll also learn something about me is I'm way too transparent. So I was expecting to be like, hey, you know, I haven't been in contact with this company for a very long time. I hope they're having fun doing what this is, and it'll be whatever it is. And what actually happened was I sat and watched folks who hadn't had a chance to express how important it is to be connected to community, how important it was to watch young people really be able to express their full selves in roles and be seen fully in all parts of themselves and identifications and locations. And that meant that they were bringing things to the work that I could have never thought of, right? The idea of leaving your shoes out before you shower is not necessarily something that is important to me culturally specific, but you could tell it was to the folks who were in this play. And anytime when you watch art where somebody is really allowing their full self to be revealed, to be vulnerable in that moment, it is a blessing. And that's what this production was. It was a blessing. It was a blessing to watch them do that. And I walked away just moved beyond. And they were sort of like, well, you wrote it. And I was like, I can't write that. There is no part of me that can instruct you to be your full self in this work. You must choose that. And they did. And that was why I was crying. That was what brought me to tears.
I think we can all agree that it's a really wonderful performance. So thank you. So you actually started writing Choir Boy in 2007.
Did I?
Yeah, apparently it says it on something that I wrote.
Okay. I believe you.
Yeah. So
what year is it now?
23.
What is time?
What amazes me is how long Survivor has been going for, right?
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Don't tell her.
So, you actually said that while a playwright is alive, that a script should be ever evolving.
Yeah.
So, how does today's production differ from the original?
Oh, well, this script, yeah. I mean, there's so much. You really want me to go through all of those? Okay, so...
You don't have to tell me about Survivor.
Okay, cool. Okay. Right, I won't. There are things that... So, the things must shift with the people who are doing it. So, for instance, lines like, oh, your voice is getting deep, huh, just growing up for Junior, was because Nick Ash had a growth spurt in the middle of doing the show, and his voice dropped 2 octaves. So I was like, true story. So Nick Ash, who was in the original production, came in one day, he was like, Terrell, I have to tell you something. And I was like, what? What is that? He was like, I'm so sorry, I don't know what happened. And I was like, me neither. Well, I'm definitely not recasting this role because you're amazing, so we're gonna figure this out. And we just rewrote the line so that Junior now has this like growth spurt in the middle of, he comes back different. And so for me, that's what I mean by like things are alive. Like I'm trying to make sure that the artists feel like they are in these roles and they have to go out there every day bravely being portions of themselves. And is that sustainable? And if the role was written in an octave two keys too high for him, he would have never been able to sustain the show. He would have been singing too high for himself and lose his voice. And so he just changed the lines. Okay. So stuff like that. There's things like that all over the place that I could literally spend all night boring the out of you about. things like some actors were better dancers, some were better, some weren't, some could, some felt very comfortable in scenes where they were in showers or like having parts of them exposed, some weren't. So like we shifted the play so that all people could feel comfortable in it. Mr. Pendleton's lines are, I wrote a role for this man named Austin Pendleton, who actually exists. He's an actor, he's a friend of mine, and he kept saying, when we would introduce him, Mr. P, just, or Pendleton, or Mr. P. And so we were like, these are gonna be your lines, because he would mess up the lines that were there. And so we made it what he said. Like, whatever you, that, put it down, put it on the piece of paper.
Actually, Mr. P is an interesting thing, because you mentioned the other day that some of the other words are also his words. So yeah. The meaning of them, you're not quite sure what they mean. I'd love you to share that.
I really don't. Like, I don't. I. Do you want me to share that I don't know what they mean?
No, just a story about, you know, where they came from, those lines.
I mean, it literally comes from that. Like the theory of relativity. I don't know what that means. I don't either. And like, cool, keep that in the scripts, right? Like, I mean, it's often interesting to me when folks are like, hey, you are such a smart writer. I'm like, no, I'm just a good listener. Right, I'm just a good listener. I listen to people and I love collaboration. I love being in a room with folks who are going to put, and I give credit where credit is due. If someone will ask me where a line comes from specific, I'll be like, that's from them. They did that. We had a very, the process for Choir Boy was a very long process in that I may have wrote it in 2007, you said?
Yeah, apparently.
We had a production in London in around 2009. And then there was a workshop for it in New York that went back and forth from 9 till 10, 11, where we did a smaller production with my friends, a lot of folks who were my friends from school. And then we did and that production toured. It went from New York to Atlanta to LA. And every time it would pick up another, you know, another Ferris, another Bobby, another, and they would bring something else different to the role. So by the time we went to Broadway, the play had filled out with a whole bunch of, you know, early career artists who were trying to find themselves in the work, and they just brought new things to it.
Okay. And in the last year alone, 8 productions of Choir Boy have been staged across the world. And I'm just really interested to think, is that actually more relevant now, this work?
Yeah, I don't know what, I honestly thought when we did it on Broadway, that would kind of be the last few times we'd see it. And mostly because, you know, I love the play, but the play is really about a young person coming to terms with who they are in their community. They identify as queer, and other, and they're trying to rectify that with their community, which may not have a space for them. And I thought, great, well, you know, we're in a world where that, we squarely know that there must be space for everyone. I'm from Florida, and I'm from a state that I couldn't do this play in right now. We literally could not do this play. We couldn't put it on. We would be shut down to try to do it. Where pride parades are being censored, where books are being banned. In fact, one of my friends, George, wrote a book called All Black Boys Aren't Blue, and that was banned in Florida, and you can't get it in Florida anywhere. And the book is in reference to characters in a television series called Queen Sugar, but also in this movie called Moonlight, which I wrote, about the character called Blue. Right. But that those characters being referenced can't, you can't find that. I don't even know. I mean, if we tried to show Moonlight, could they might want to stop us from doing that, which is weird because I'm like, we won you Academy Award with it, right? I don't know how many Academy Awards for Best Picture Florida has, but I know that we got it for you. So like, but that doesn't matter in the face of like the kind of politics that is happening. And so the fact that this story is that relevant now and it's picking up steam all over the place is really, it's actually disconcerting. It's great that we have it, but it's disconcerting that it is still so relevant. I the day that folks go and like, yeah, cool, that's a good cautionary tale, would be a joyous day.
And you actually have mentioned that you started performing on the street at a young age.
Yeah.
And I mean, other people might want to know what you were performing on the street, but how has this influenced your relationship with audiences?
Yeah, we did a lot of, we did this thing called prevention theater. So my mother was in rehab for drug addiction, and I was about 13 or 14 years old, very interested in the theater already. And they started a program where the children of the folks in rehab could go out and talk to other kids in the community about drugs. And so you can imagine how easy that is when you're like, don't do drugs. And that became kind of a hallmark moment. It was a benchmark moment for me because I really realized that there was no way to talk to the people in my community about not doing drugs when it was surrounding us, when our parents were doing it, when it was a part of our life in a way that we needed to discuss transparently, openly, and without a lot of judgment. And so the work we started to write came from a place of, hey, this is happening in my home too. So how do we talk about this? And a lot of the things we did were about grabbing the attention of folks. So I learned very quickly that you can kind of be in front of an audience and I can pretend there's a fourth wall, or I can go, oh, she's running to see her friend. Right? And now all of a sudden we are live together watching that person run to see their friends. Right? And that is a shared moment. Now that is live. Now we are together. Right? You're nodding with me. Right? And those moments of interaction allow us to both believe in what is happening, meaning there's something happening here, and also the connectivity here. And our brains are built for that. Those are the oldest parts of our synapses coming alive and imagining something together. So when you start learning that, energy and how to practice in it, it starts becoming a part of how you shape the way you communicate with the world. So I'm not very good at 101. If you come up to me, if you see me and you're like, Terrell, I'm gonna be like, hey, and I'm probably gonna duck and be very awkward, right? But if you ask me a question here, because I have practiced this enough, I know many ways to get across my point, to engage you in a way that I can feel like we can lean in and be together, and all feel like the conversation is moving towards something where we have connectivity. And so that's, you know, I practice that more than I practice asking people out on dates, which is probably why I was single for a very long time. And so you have to chalk it up to growing up in the theater and growing up learning those things. And that, you can see it in most of my work. It has a kind of openness or performance-ness to it. I want you to know that there is a performance happening in front of you live, right? Not that you can sort of go and duck and hide and be somewhere else, but that they see you seeing them. In Brother Size, they literally turn out and they'll say something like, Terrell scratches his nose. He takes a deep breath. A really deep breath, right? And that makes us have to be together on the journey of the story. So those are the things that came out of that learning. And it was a very important, again, a formative time for me. And it's again, a part of my work now. It's also part of the things that I'm torturing these poor writers with in Australia. They're like, every day I come in and I'm reading something else and they're going, oh God, I really wish he would shut up. And I'm just like, don't believe it. They're falling asleep. They're mutinying every day. We do have nice snacks, though. That we do. You all, y'all got good food in Australia.
Yes, it's fresh.
It's so good. I've eaten so well, except now I'm in Lent, so I've been eating a lot of beans and lentils. So, but yeah, that wasn't the question. What was the question?
I think you answered the question.
Got it.
But also, too, in your writing now, you think about audiences when you're writing?
Yeah. So when I write film, I mostly, especially if I'm writing a film, I think about what's the last image the audience is going to see first. And if I don't know what that is, I stop writing the film. And if I'm writing a play, I'm definitely thinking about how that engagement is going to work. What's the performative nature? So in Choir Boy, there is a lot of music. And there is a choir, a live choir. Those folks are singing live, mostly, if not all, a cappella, the entire show. Right? And you think that doesn't make a difference, but that is what is making you lean in, is the fact that they could get a wrong note from somewhere, throw the whole thing off, and have to recalibrate. But they're doing it right in front of you every time as best they can. And that live modification of music, it's actually, your brains pick it up. You pick up that you're listening to it live. There's this study with babies that they've played, and they played Mozart for the baby through speakers, and then they played it live, and the baby responded differently when it was live. It got up, looked around, tried to find out where it was coming from. Even though it wasn't in the same room, it could tell somebody's playing this. And that's the difference. That is something happening in the space. There's a movement happening. Those fellas on stage are actually moving the spirit, right, through sound. They are blessing each other and you in the space. And so I always think about, what is your experience when you are engaging this story? What is the ritual that you're going through with the story?
And you've mentioned that you encourage your students to be present in their own environments and to write about their own worlds. So as a person of colour, to what extent do you feel responsibility around authenticity and community? And do you feel it's an unfair burden?
I identify as Black. I'm a Black person. And not that there is a difference between being a person of color and Black where I'm from. Oftentimes we use person of color to skirt the anti-Blackness that is in existence. And so I am Black. That is who I am. That is what I've always been. I don't know, I mean, yes. Life as a Black person is unfair. I don't know that I find it unfair to engage my community. I don't find that unfair. I don't find it unfair to celebrate that in my work. I don't. I know other folks are like, well, I would like to do something else. Great, they should be able to do that. That is unfair. But the fact that, you know, a culture of about 13% of the population or less has influenced the world, right? Often we talk about Black culture in America, and it's really an interesting thing because Black culture in America is actually American culture. Like, that's what we sell. That's what America exports, right? Everywhere in the world you can hear hip hop. That's American culture because it's Black culture. And hip hop is based on the creation or on the amalgamation of music, this sacred music that you heard in Choir Boy. It's all built off the same legacy, the same struggle, the same protest songs, all of the jazz that is made, the jazz that has become the samples to hip hop, all of that is interwoven in our culture. And so taking parts of that and celebrating in it, I always feel glad about it.
I am just going to hand over to Q&A in just one second.
Okay.
But I also, final question from me is, what's a question you wished you were asked?
None. I'm an Aquarius rising, Aquarius moon. I don't want no questions. I'm always like, don't ask me nothing. Don't ask me anything. But, you know, I'm happy to answer them, but just know I'm mad awkward, you know?
Well, that's a really good sign then for someone who might like to ask a question.
Yeah.
Thank you, sister. Hi, what's up? What's up? Thank you for your play. And thank you for letting me be in it. It's incredible. I'm obsessed. I do want to ask, I wasn't going to ask this because I kind of had answered it myself, but I, like, as a light-skinned black person, you know, like, what was it like for you? Because as far as I know, all other iterations of this play in America have been performed by dark-skinned black people. And I know there is a difference between, like, my experience versus somebody who's dark-skinned. So, like, what was it like for you to come here and see that there's, you know, you got light skins in the play? You know, it's a weird question, but it's like there's nuance in it, and I think it's important. So,
sure. I mean, if you're asking my experience of the play, I experienced the play as something that was very sacred to you all. So that's what I saw first. I didn't recognize that you all were light skinned until later. Honestly, and it was mostly because we were, the majority of you were light-skinned, and it was in relief to, like, oh, we had a hard time casting this play, right? Because of the social location of the play, we had a hard time casting. And I was like, oh, why? And then I was like, oh, duh, right? But because you all were, again, were so authentic to yourself and to what you needed to be in the play, it didn't dawn on me that there was a disconnect. There may have been a cultural or social disconnect, if that makes any sense. Like I saw people who were yearning to be heard, yearning to be seen for their full selves in a way that felt authentic to me. So I didn't even register it. There's someone here and there's someone there.
Hello.
Yo, all right, hi. So one of the scenes I thought was really interesting, but also I feel like was parochial, as in, like, I feel like it was very American, so I was, like, trying to get context to it, but I got some context. Sorry. The scene where they're in class and they're arguing about the spiritual songs, I was wondering if you could just talk about the two sides to that argument and how it relates to your own, maybe, spirituality, cool if not. Just that, yeah, that seemed like a real heart of a lot of what was happening to me, so I just wanted to hear you talk about the two sides of that.
Sure. You all have seen the play, right?
Yeah. Oh, sorry.
It's okay.
That's all right. You all have seen the play? Cool. So I'm not spoiling anything. Don't want to be that good. There are two major arguments. There is a scene where Ferris is arguing a point about spirituals, which is that we are often taught in schools, well, not anymore, right, because African-American history is being erased from our schools, but we were taught that these songs, Negro spirituals, had messages in them that told you how to escape enslavement, right? Now, it's very hard to prove that because, again, they were covert operations. So nobody wrote down the plans of, like, okay, well, then this song does X. Like, there is no living memory of how exactly they worked. They also, most of those songs, like Keep Your Hand on the Plow, or Ain't Nobody Gonna Turn Me Around, or even Wondrous Love, Precious Lord, all of those songs are used as protest songs or songs to steal the spirit in the middle of the kind of adversity that black folk, mostly black folk, would be experiencing through protesting in the civil rights movement starting after the end of World War II. And so Ferris's argument is that we can prove, right? We can literally look at those songs and see how they became chants for people who were on strike, for garbage workers who were on strike, for people who were trying to protest police brutality. Even today, those songs are being sung, right? There are a bunch of women in New Orleans protesting for reproductive rights, right? And they're singing songs like Ain't Nobody Gonna Turn Me Around. They're literally singing these same songs to engage their spirit because they're in a spiritual warfare, right? Not just a physical one. And that's his point. And so he's not wrong in his point. He's just also 16. And all 16-year-olds, as former President Barack Obama says, should have a chance to F up.
right? And he messes up by saying, like, that is the most important way. And it can be both. Two things can exist at once. They could have been covert operations and filled with ways in which formerly enslaved folks found freedom. They could be, absolutely. There's no reason why they shouldn't be. In fact, they probably more than likely were, right? And they are songs that enliven our spirits, engage us in the kind of political and spiritual, personal warfare we have to engage. And so that's what the argument was, is that students being myopic about a thing. They're only this. They were only that. And they're ceremonial. We sing them to remember the fact that our ancestors could do X, Y, and Z. Absolutely. To just draw a line between us and say, well, this is where we don't meet. Rather than be like, well, you know, both of these things can be true, right? And that's true of youngness. Like, you get to be young and dumb for a reason, right? You should be able to run into a couple of things before you go, oh man, if I had just been like, yeah, that's true, and that's true, I could have not had a bloody nose that day, or whatever it is that happens to the end of it. But we get in the heat of, and sometimes even as adults, we don't learn past, oh, let me just open my heart gaze up just a little longer, bigger, so I can encapsulate all that is happening here. What's being brought to this argument? Why does Bobby need to hold on to the fact that this is actually a tradition? What does it mean for him to actually be able to hold on to something that is being passed to him? Could it be that he feels like he's losing his legacy? And so if Ferris could see that, Ferris might be quiet long enough to be like, I see your point. It is important for you to be connected to your family in that way. But he can't. He's 16.
Hi, Terrell.
Hey.
How are you? This is a question I asked Darren today during our warm-ups.
Okay.
And they told me to ask you because apparently you would have a better answer to it.
I will try.
So, the end scene, this is just out of curiosity for me, where Ferris asked the headmaster, would you rather be feared or respected? I'm just curious, if he said feared, where would the play have gone? Like, why would respected be the reason why Ferris confesses about what had happened? Because initially when the scene starts, it doesn't feel like Ferris has any intention of, like, telling him what actually happens. He's like, no, I fell. This is what happened. And then he's like, would you rather be feared or respected? Which is like a repeated motif from the start with the headmaster and Ferris scene. And I'm just curious as if the headmaster would have said, I would rather be feared. What would Ferris's story be then? Like, what would Ferris?
Yeah, Darren answered it better than me, because I have no idea. No, I honestly don't. I don't know. I've never even thought about it. I could go think about it and come up with something. Great, do it. Live. I honestly am interested. I have no idea. I know, so sorry. My bad. Seriously, I wish I had thought about, like, that's a good question that I wish I had thought of. I didn't, and I have no idea. I know what happens in this play because I wrote that, but I wrote that down on a piece of paper and handed it to people. They read the lines and we do it, so. Any other questions, comments, gifts of cash?
Hello.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm all right.
That's great.
Thanks.
My name's Andrea, and my question was, I hear you use the words spiritual warfare, and this play has what feels like it's filled with the spirit, like, in its core. Like, you said that this was staged in 2007, and you were workshopping till 2011, 2012. Do you have a relationship with God? Like,
yeah.
What's that like for you, especially given that, you know, you said Moonlight was sort of based on your life, and how has that evolved throughout this process?
Sure. I don't know that it has evolved with with the process specific, I think of spiritual practice as a practice, so it's always evolving. I don't know if that it evolved in the relationship to the play, if that makes any sense. But there are things in the play that are reflections of my religious practice. For example, the bedrock of it is that I had a grandparent who taught me that my relationship with God was nobody else's. Like he could not go to God or what is larger for me, that I could only go for myself, and that I would only know in the, as he put it, in the closet of my life, right, in the corridor of my prayer, that would be my relationship and the building block. So there was no way that, you know, even if he disapproved of my lifestyle, the way I lived, that wasn't for me and him to talk about. It was for me and God. And so my practice has always been that, to have a kind of intimate relationship with something bigger than myself. The play and its evolution is really about me sort of figuring out how to stage the sacred while also making sure that we're talking to people who are still figuring out their secular. Meaning, students are always sort of given a responsibility to grow up in a way, to be the best, to go on to this next thing. And we pass on a legacy of very powerful tools to them that they sometimes don't know how to use, don't know how to engage. And one of the ways in which I mean that is to say, Ferris says, I was taught how to be able to go to God for strength, right? Or Bobby says, these songs are to help you when you know the world out there is against you, right? Those are pretty powerful tools to have. Now, they have no clue when and how to activate them yet because they don't have practice in it, right? But it is important that we watch them figure out, oh, wow, there is something I have that I can do. When Bobby needs and he is in grief, the community around him has a way to touch him, to make him feel like he's connected to something bigger than himself and that the pain that he's in right now isn't always. That's a pretty powerful thing to have as a 17-year-old, 16-year-old, 15-year-old. And we watched them engage that. And so the play was always about calibrating that. How much of a spiritual moment is that baptism? It was always a baptism to me, but how much of it can I make it for you so that you understand that that's what's happening in the space?
I think we've got time for one more down here.
Hi,
thank you.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi. This is just a softball one, because I just like to ask, I think it's a nice question, or maybe it's not. We'll find out. I just want to ask, what do you love the most, what is the thing about storytelling you love the most, and how has that changed over time, if it has?
The sharing.
Yeah.
It's always been about sharing. It's all the way, that I don't know that it has changed. It might. But the ability for things to be shared and engaged, that's always been my favorite. You cutting us off? Closing the bar.
Well, I just know you have an early starts.
I do.
Yeah. So I'd just like to thank everyone for being here with us tonight. And I would like to also thank Terrell for offering to do this Q&A for us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. And one final thank you. Terrell is here because of the Gergensen Foundation. So thank you to them as well. So good night, everyone.
Station the Nation is a production of Riverside's National Theatre of Parramatta, produced and recorded at Riverside Theatres Parramatta. Thank you to the Australia Council's Resilience Fund and also City of Parramatta, Create New South Wales and Riverside Theatres. And of course, thank you to you all for listening.